Hello there, and welcome to the very first official episode of the Parallax Podcast. My name is Luke Buckmaster. I'm joined by the ever terrific, unbelievably handsome, and thoroughly inimitable Mr. Rich Harrity.
That's me.
Last episode was our pilot episode, and pilot episodes are basically a way of saying, well, if this is a bit crap, don't judge us. But we received a terrific response, didn't we, Rich?
We received a lot of responses.
A deluge.
Yeah. Well, most of the commentary was about my use of the word melange.
It rolls off your tongue.
I enjoy saying it a lot. Do you want me to say it again?
Not really.
Well, here we go. Melange.
Wow, melange. That is fantastic. I received several FOI requests, bras in the mail, and a little bit of anthrax turned out to be caster sugar.
Yeah. I actually made a cake out of your anthrax sugar. It was quite delicious.
Mm.
Yeah.
It sounds horrible. What are we talking about today? We've got The Killer Elite.
The Killer Elite, a little local film starring Robert De Niro.
Bob De Niro.
Yeah.
And Carnage?
Carnage, a film by Roman Polanski that involves
Polanski.
Very little child molestation.
That's right.
Yes.
He's past that. And we've got on DVD Contagion, Steven Soderbergh.
Yeah, which involves me touching Luke and giving him my viruses.
And I feel horribly sick because of it. And then Midnight in Paris, and afterwards, the great Zach Hepburn is going to join us.
Yes.
Can't wait for that. He's going to do something backcountry crazy.
I have no idea what he's going to do today.
He's our resident cult film expert. Why don't you take us away with our first review, Rich?
First up, The Killer Elite.
It killed Craig and Harris. We have to do something.
Close it down.
You have no idea who you're messing with.
Did you hear this number?
He's like a father to you, right?
You don't do this as a dead man.
Killer Elite tells the story of Jason Statham as Jason Statham, an ex-assassin for hire who gets dragged back into the game after his old assassin friend Robert De Niro, playing Robert De Niro, gets kidnapped by some Arab oil barons. Statham is blackmailed into killing three ex-SAS officers who were responsible for killing three of the Arab family in an operation in Oman several years prior. Nothing is as simple as it seems, though, when a secret society of ex-SAS agents called the Feathermen appear and aren't too happy to hear about their men getting knocked off. Entirely abusing the tag based on a true story, Killer Elite is a thoroughly middle-of-the-road action piece. Adapted from source material that amusingly labelled itself factional, a horribly pretentious and stupid way to say your story is 90% made up, this film can't seem to decide what it wants to be. Quite a bit of screen time is taken up building this hokey world of spies and conspiracies, but it's often punctuated by such inane dialogue that you can't help but laugh. One amusing scene has a bunch of white men sitting around a table, spouting usefully expositional lines such as, "What we're doing is illegal!" and, "We are ex-SAS agents, no one can know what we're doing." It's that type of film, and it sadly doesn't seem to know it, hamming in some ho-hum political statement about the bad things our governments do for oil. The most useful thing to say about the film is that it was mostly shot in Melbourne, and it's a lot of fun for local viewers to play spot the location in between recognising lots of familiar Aussie actors spouting bizarre accents. Did you get anything else out of this film than I, Luke?
Well, I've got to say, first of all, I'm very glad that you mentioned the whole based on a true story thing, and I fail to see how you couldn't mention it, considering my first couple of thoughts about this film is that, one, the most entertaining thing about watching Killer Elite is looking at those words based on a true story. And it's just a great encapsulation of how absolutely trite and futile and meaningless those words are. You know, how many totally fictitious films have you seen that are 100 times more truthful, more realistic than this one? And that's the first thing I found that bumped in my thought I've seen this film. The second was how strange it was in the sense that it's a globe-trotting action film that darts between locations. You've got London, Paris, the Yarra Valley, and so on and so forth. But there's virtually no sense of travel. You know, it's like the characters have moved absolutely nowhere. And I actually felt it maybe needed one of those map traveling scenes, you know, with the arrow and the plane, Indiana Jones style, or the Muppets movie style.
Well, that's the great thing about being a local viewer, because apart from like their establishing shots, like that were obviously second unit, let's take an airline, like a shot of Paris or something. Apart from those shots, most of it was Melbourne. There was some of the London scenes were actually London, but all the Paris scenes were Melbourne. And seeing,
aside from a couple of really long shots.
And then seeing Melbourne redressed as Paris is particularly amusing. Like,
and we've got Parliament Station, which Melburnians will recognise Parliament Station.
There's a great scene, and it's near the end, so I don't want to kind of pull out the details to spoil it, but it does involve Robert De Niro and a shootout in Parliament Station, which is dressed up as a Paris train station in the late 70s, and it's absolutely hilarious because anyone that travels on the trains will recognize that that train stop and that train station, and it's quite amusing to see Robert De Niro running around with a gun.
True. But you know, great scene. No, not a great scene. I thought it was actually tremendously disappointing. Anyone who's been to Parliament Station in Melbourne knows it has these giant escalators. They go down very, very deep. They're actually huge. And what an absolute disgrace it was that Jason Statham didn't slide down, water slide style, down the middle of one of those bad boys. You know, that's a missed opportunity. And you saying that Robert De Niro plays Robert De Niro, which basically means it's some sort of over-the-hill actor playing a kind of over-the-hill actor. Yeah, like, it's anyone who's followed his career over the last 10 years is going to think, not unsurprisingly, that he looks like a bit of a goose in this film, doesn't he?
It's a glorified cameo, but I've got to say, like, I loved Jason Statham. I love the blankness in his face. There's a couple of sequences in the film where there's a lot of great meaning for his character, and he's having huge, hesitant moments about doing hits and stuff like that, and flashbacks to crazy times in the past, and it keeps cutting back to close-ups of Statham's face, and it's just the one blank Statham expression.
But he is blank. He's got no expression.
But it's awesome. It's like a Rorschach test that you can project whatever emotion. It's like, yeah, happy sure. Statham, sad Statham, it's all the same.
Yeah, and that's right. It's all the same.
I find it glorious to watch. I really enjoy it.
It's pretty terrible to watch. But I will say that in terms of the Killer Elite's crowning achievements is that it actually manages to take the question of how you take a globe-trotting hitman movie full of action and find a way to make it boring. And there is just a soullessness that sweeps through the film.
Well, you know, wait and get it on DVD. It'll pass the time with a few drinks on a Friday night.
Yeah, make that more than a few. Next up, also in cinemas now, Carnage.
You know, I was wondering, and I know this is not important, but do you know what they were arguing about? Because Ethan won't say a word.
Ethan wouldn't let Zachary be a part of his gang.
Ethan has a gang?
And he called him a snitch.
Did you know that Ethan had a gang?
No, but I'm thrilled to hear it.
Carnage is the latest feature film from the legendary Roman Polanski, a varied and bold director whose name is sadly often associated with statutory rape. Don't hate it when that happens. And not his rich and often extraordinary work. The film was adapted by Yasmina Reza from her own play, and it's a single-setting production based in an upper-class New York apartment where two married couples spend the lion's share of the running time arguing and bickering and cussing with each other. The reason they meet is to resolve a primary school bullying incident involving their respective children, but as the evening progresses, it descends into a pretty contrived confection of chaos, earmarked by splatters of vomit, literal and emotive, silly discussions about a hamster, and so on and so forth. The four performances in the film, from Christoph Waltz, Kate Winslet, Jodie Foster, and John C. Reilly, are all strong, you know, quite strong. It's the writing that falls down, and the script's circular momentum really grates. It's like a mouse running endlessly on a wheel. It's kind of got no concept of its own monotony. Carnage was very obviously based on a play, and I suspect not a very good one. There is nothing actually very cinematic about this film, and virtually all of it feels like unnecessary exposition. I was very disappointed with Carnage, and I'm a big Polanski fan. Rich?
What? Nothing cinematic about the film? I found it incredibly cinematic. Yes, it's based on a play, and yes, you're hamstrung by your single setting, and like with most play adaptations, it really will only be ever what it is. But I found that Polanski's staging of the film was always interesting. There wasn't, to me, one wasted or boring composition in the entire film. From the playful use of mirrors that Polanski used in some of his framings, to the really clever foreshadowing of props that played a part in later stages of the narrative, I found it an incredibly cinematic and always interesting use of staging in terms of a filmed play.
You see, none of that came alive to me. And primarily, I put it down to a problem with the writing. I think this is a dull play. I haven't actually seen a production of the play, so you know I should be careful with saying that, but I think it's a dull script. And I did not feel for any of the characters. I didn't feel that his staging was, you know, cinematic in the ways that you've described.
Well, I didn't feel for any of the characters, but I thought that was incredibly intentional. I felt like all the characters were there and designed to be laughed at and judged by the audience. And
but did you find it funny as a comedy? I didn't find it funny at all.
Yeah, you're telling me you didn't find the vomiting? Yeah, the best vomit sequence I've seen in a long time.
There's a scene where Kate Winslet vomits, and I found that was just a sort of desperate attempt to propel the plot forward, where it was actually doing nothing beforehand. I mean, I giggled a couple of times, in all fairness.
I found it a really entertaining film, and it was only 79 minutes. It never outstayed its welcome, and it played out a really entertaining story, and I've got to recommend it. I've got to say that it's a fun little piece of cinema.
Yeah, look, it was nice and mercilessly, I should say, short. It still managed to overstay its welcome for me, even though it was
79 minutes. And it still was a bit too long for it.
But I think you're actually really right in saying that Polanski is doing something with the material on a visual level. He's a very confident filmmaker, he's very assured, and he's very bold. And I think particularly the opening scene where you just see a shot, and it's not really necessarily relevant to what happens afterwards, but you see a shot of a playground incident, with a really sort of powerful score backing that up. And it's clear from that stage that this guy is still on top of his elements. I just don't think he was actually able to bring much to this script. I was really disappointed.
Oh, but it's minor Polanski, like, for sure. And if his name wasn't behind the film, I think the film would be much more highly regarded. But if you're coming to it as a Polanski film, you'll be disappointed. If you're coming to it as just a fun piece of film theatre with some really good performances from some great modern actors, then I think you'll enjoy the film.
Maybe.
I disagree. I think it's a worthwhile film. It's a minor Polanski film, but it's a fun film.
And you know where you can keep having fun? You can keep having fun by listening to the Parallax Podcast. Isn't that right, Rich?
Yes, have fun with us.
Fun.
Fun.
Lots of fun.
A little bit.
Well, we've got some fun here.
Yeah, this is a bit
fun. We're plumb out of fun.
Yeah, okay, there's no fun left. Next up, currently on DVD, Contagion.
On day one, there were two people, and then four, and then 16. In 3 months, it's a billion. That's where we're headed.
They're calling out the National Guard. They're moving the president underground.
People will panic.
Get away!
It will tip over.
The truth is being kept from the world.
Cook your samples, destroy everything.
Steven Soderbergh has to be one of the most interesting filmmakers of the last 10 or 20 years. Even after over 20 years in the business, he still creates incredibly playful cinema, constantly experimenting with the limits of genre, narrative, and form. Contagion is his take on the big Hollywood disaster movie, and the film follows the spread of a bird flu-like virus which quickly turns into a worldwide pandemic. In typical Soderbergh fashion, this film isn't exactly what you would expect from the usual Hollywood treatment. This is no Outbreak. There are no helicopter chases, and Dustin Hoffman doesn't appear looking for a monkey. Instead, Contagion is a cool, precise, and dare I say it, clinical examination of how the world would react if faced with a disaster such as this. Despite the high-profile cast, there is no central character in the film outside of the virus itself. Soderbergh weaves a myriad of narrative threads showing different facets of world reaction. The best way to describe the feeling of watching Contagion is that it's like watching a week's worth of live cable news reporting in 100 minutes. There's a frightening observational quality to the film that will not be to everyone's taste, but I, for one, found it enthralling. As with many Soderbergh films, it's not particularly perfect, especially in its broad treatment of some of the characters. Bloggers, for example, are not treated well by the screenplay. But overall, it's such a fascinating take on a generic story that I can't help but recommend it. Luke, did you want to watch your hands incessantly after watching the film as much as I?
Perhaps, but maybe for different reasons. First of all, I've got to say, this film could really have done with Dustin Hoffman and a monkey. I'm a big fan of Outbreak, and I will defend that film to the hilt.
I'm a fan of Outbreak too, and I like monkeys and Dustin Hoffman.
And B, you're exactly right. It does actually feel like a week's worth of live reporting from a cable TV network in 100 minutes. Now, does that make an interesting movie? I would suggest no.
I like watching cable news. I really do.
I guess that's where me and you differ, Rich.
Well, if shit was hitting the fan, you would be 24/7 watching CNN or something like that, and you would be flicking channels, and this would be how you would experience an outbreak.
That's
true,
and I would hate myself for it. I think what you were saying in your review is actually spot on in the sense that you know, let's get some perspective here. This is an experimental film, isn't it? This is a bold film in some ways.
It is. Like, much like all of Soderbergh's efforts in big Hollywood, it's an experimental take on
Ocean's Eleven wasn't very experimental.
No, but, you know, everyone's got to make money.
Well, yeah, it wasn't very experimental. Look, the interesting thing about Contagion is, yeah, it is a daring film in some senses. There's no three-act structure. There's actually no protagonist, and I think that was quite interesting. Every time you think there's a main character in the film, it shifts. They'll get dropped
for 30, 40 minutes at a time. Like, it's interesting.
That's interesting. There's no really sentimental resolutions or anything like that. But the film is cold and clinical. And for me, it really reminded me of a kind of politician sticking to the line on a really tricky issue. There's no spectacle. There's no flamboyant movements. Instead, it's like a set of carefully guarded responses to a complicated situation.
What, you need an explosion to keep you interested?
Well, that would have been nice. But no, I don't need an explosion to keep me interested. But a little bit of emotion. How about that? I mean, this devastating disease is sweeping across the globe.
Well, I think in the Matt Damon storyline is where you're meant to get your emotion from.
Indeed,
It's a father that's got to take care of his daughter and he's lost his wife. And that's where the day-to-day aspect of this narrative is covered. He's seeing his neighborhood go to hell and he's trying to protect his daughter, and I think that's where the emotion lives in the film.
Isn't really an emotional film though, is it?
I mean, no, but does it need to be?
Well, it doesn't need to be, but I think there's a danger on the one hand of saying this is a great experimental film because it's unemotional, and then saying on the other hand that there's some emotion with Matt Damon's character. I think that primarily Soderbergh is trying to second guess how people respond to situations. Authorities, vested interests, and so on and so forth. And I think he's ultimately more concerned about actually showing you the repercussions politically of a contagion than actually showing you the emotional effects or how it actually affects people's day-to-day lives in a meaningful way.
Well, if that's his intention, what's the problem with that?
Well, I just didn't find it a very involving film.
See, but I did. I found it fascinating to watch how the world would react to a huge virus spread like this. That's interesting. I don't care, to be honest, how a day-to-day person deals with that, even though that is covered to a small degree in the film. But the global effects of what would happen if a virus spreads around the world in such a quick period of time is fascinating to me.
Look, it was mildly interesting to me, and I do think the film has a cold, dead heart.
I think people need to be prepared for what this type of film is, and it might be a bit deceptive approaching a film with a cast like this.
Yeah.
Thinking it's going to be a type of generic Hollywood product. And it's not. So people need to be prepared for what it is. And it's a very different type of virus disaster film, despite the fact that it's got that cast. And if you approach the film knowing that, I think you're more likely to get a lot more out of it.
Yeah, look, I think it's an intelligently made film. I'm not denying it that. I think it's tense. And some scenes are even nail-chewing, but I think you need to take this film as an extremely long introduction to a work that was never finished.
I entirely disagree.
I think it feels just totally incomplete. Where's the rest of the film?
I really enjoyed this film.
It's up Soderbergh's bum.
And I'm willing to have a look up Soderbergh's bum if it's that interesting. Just wash your hands, though. Like, yeah, there's probably viruses up there.
Well, I don't know if you have to wash your hands if you're only looking, but if
if you've got someone plans, else to help you open it. I don't know. What are we talking about again?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, is it?
Yeah. What's up next?
I don't know. Should we move on?
Yeah, let's move on. Yeah, it's getting awkward. And now for our next DVD review, Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris.
Now, this is a writer, Gil. Yes, Gil.
Gil Pender.
Hemingway?
You liked my book.
Liked? I loved all your work.
Yes, it was a good book because it was an honest book. And that's what war does to men.
A Trip Down Memory Lane are the first words that come to mind after watching Woody Allen's time travel romance, Midnight in Paris. In the film, Owen Wilson plays Jill, a likable, slightly mellowed version of Allen himself, with maybe a dash of Paul Giamatti-style neurosis thrown in for good measure. Jill is a well-off Hollywood writer. Most of Allen's characters, in fact, are middle-upper-class people, and he strolls the streets of Paris seeking inspiration to finish his first novel. Jill is engaged to a pretty but fairly highly strong fiancé, played by Rachel McAdams, and her family are snitchy upper crust cranks who vote Republican, a far cry from Jill's dreamy left of center personality. When the hour clocks midnight one evening, Jill, alone on the street, is transported back in time to the 1920s, where he meets some of his most admired writers and artists, including Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, T.S. Eliot, and Pablo Picasso, and thus begins an enchantingly nostalgic but deceptively complex romantic drama with a light and frothy feel, framed, directed, acted, and scored with a beautiful, beautiful deftness of touch. Midnight in Paris is, well, dare I say, cinematic champagne, bubbly, palatable, and very Moorish. The way Woody Allen embraces nostalgia while simultaneously making the point that through the mist of reflection, things are not always what they are remembered or perceived to be, is genius. Midnight in Paris isn't just the most financially successful Woody Allen film of all time. It's collected more than $120 million at the worldwide box office. It's also one of his finest. Personally, I doubt Allen will ever beat Annie Hall, his incredibly charming 1977 rom-com. I just adore that film. But this one, I think, is up there with some of his best work. Rich, I'm judging by you interrupting my review there that you don't agree.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
It's okay. Yeah, it's okay. I'm enchanted by this film, so I'm in a very forgiving mood.
I couldn't hold down the torrent of emotion that was building up inside me in disagreeance.
Evidently not.
And is disagreeance a word? Let's call disagreeance a word.
It's a word.
It's a word now.
Coining words on the Parallax podcast.
Disagreeance. See, watching this film, for me, it felt like I was sitting in a university cafe with a first-year art student who was drinking a latte and constantly name-dropping random artists in a pretentious conversation of one-upmanship that usually resulted in me wanting to punch someone in the face. And I can tell you there were definitely moments when I wanted to punch this film in the face.
I'm fascinated in a lot of respects by the way people look back on their own lives, and not just their own lives, but society in general, and they think things were so much better back then. Things were rosier. The past was a better place to live. And one of the great things about Midnight in Paris is it makes that observation. And yes, the past is rosy, while at the same time condemning that line of thinking.
I think when it comes down to it, I had huge problems with this film. And One of the things that I know we've talked about in the past is this idea of films that play to the back row, or stories that play to the back row, in terms of a smug comment about maybe lowbrow films. But I think this film plays to the front row by dropping numerous literary and art in-jokes that have no function other than to pat the audience on the back for having read more than one book in their life. There's nothing witty or clever about these scenes.
Are you just feeling bad because you haven't read The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald? Haven't you? Have you read that book?
I've read the Wikipedia description of it.
Oh, it's a fantastic novel. Look, it's one of the best American novels I've ever read.
I'm aware of it, and I'm aware of the references that Allen is playing with in this film, but they're no more than self-congratulatorily smug, pat on the back, I recognize this thing. Some of them are even stupid and borderline offensive. The last scene, for example, like one of the later scenes, where Gil offers Louis Buñuel the idea for his 1962 film, The Exterminating Angel, only to have Buñuel respond with, "I don't get it," is not only frustratingly pointless, outside of like the simple, "Hey, do you get this movie reference?" but it's also making Buñuel look like an idiot. I don't understand the point of lots of these references. Other than to have their intellectual audience sit back and go,
I think you're being really rough on this film. I think you're being really rough on it. I get that perhaps you need to be cast under its spell, I think, for this film to work. I was, you weren't.
No, that is absolutely
Are you sure you didn't see this film right after the end of work, so you essentially saw maybe 5:30 p.m. in Paris and I saw Midnight in Paris? Because I thought this was such a wonderful film.
I've seen it twice now, just to be sure.
Both 5:30 p.m.?
Well, one time at 5:25.
Uh-huh.
But yes, yeah.
You knew that?
But look, I've seen it twice. It annoys me. It annoyed me as much the second time as it did the first time.
Again, I think you're being really rough on this film. Gertrude Stein, played by Kathy Bates, says in Midnight in Paris, "The artist's job is to find an antidote for the emptiness of existence." Now, I found an antidote with this film.
I found that I needed to look for the antidote after seeing this film because it didn't make me feel good.
And the antidote, if you want an antidote to whatever ails you, just keep watching or listening to. Well, if you can watch it, then best to you. You've got hidden cameras in this room right now.
Wonderful segue.
Listening to the Parallax Podcast. And now on the Parallax Podcast, we have cult movie aficionado Zach Head-on-a-Stick Hepburn, who joins us now on the podcast couch. Now, Rich, Zach hasn't told us what film he'll be discussing this episode. I assume probably because it's unspeakably out there or preposterously weird, or he's just afraid we'll knock him back because it's so strange and eclectic. How's that scotch going for you? Maybe you should refill your glass.
What is this, 15-year-old scotch?
It's a 15-year-old Dalwhinnie single Highland malt scotch.
Okay, well, I think I might need... Hang on, I was in that right now.
This is not sponsored, this episode, by the way.
Oh, God. That's horrible.
And on that note, Zach, welcome to the couch. You are also drinking 15-year-old Dalwhinnie single Highland malt scotch.
For simple times, make it Dalwhinnie times.
And this is absolutely not sponsored by Dalwhinnie. Zach, can you please explain to us, tell us, please, we're waiting, begging you. What are we talking
gentlemen,
about?
Gentlemen, I bring you today a curiosity from some planet far away. It's a Crispin Hellion Glover's second directorial feature. It's fine. Everything is fine. Now, this film, I don't know if either of you gentlemen have seen this.
I have not.
Rich has seen it. It looks like that's one-on-one. Basically, this film's not been released on home video or DVD, or you can't even get a torrent of it on the internet. Crispin Glover personally takes the film around to show, and he also does like a little talk and whatnot in front of it, like a slideshow. It's called Crispin Glover's Big Sideshow or something like that. He did it at Acme probably about three or four years ago.
Yeah, something like that.
And he also played his first feature, What Is It?, which is a whole different kettle of fish. But here today, we're here to talk about It's Fine, Everything is Fine. It was made in 2007, and it's basically a narrative feature, which is written by its star, a Utah-based actor, Stephen C. Stewart, who did actually die a little bit after the film.
It's about a month after finishing.
Because he was inflicted with cerebral palsy, which is a main kind of element of the film.
Yes, it is.
There's not really... Look, I'm going to open up this review pretty much just by giving you an idea of what the film's like. It's like someone's taken a Norman Rockwell painting, shit on it, and kind of spun it around, and it's hit everyone in the face. And that would be my introduction to this sort of stuff. It's like, it's a very simple story. The fact that Stephen plays his own character, his own name, is a disabled person who is being looked after. And he has these strange fantasies at first of strangling his carers. And then it goes on to another threshold, and then he starts to often be involved with them either sexually, or he gets sexual favors off the internet, and then he goes about strangling the people that he has just had sex with.
What? How old is this film?
From about 2007, so it's not been rated, never gone through any sort of classification bureau or anything like that. Yeah,
Who needs a classification bureau when you have guerrilla filmmaking,
shithouse Norman Rockwell painting thrown all over the over the wall. It is one of the strangest things you will ever see. Glover has said that he specifically made it in the style of a 1970s TV movie, so it has this real sort of hazy, almost sort of like womb-like quality to it. All these very deep reds, very saturated sort of colours. The sound design is very protracted. It's really like... I've never seen anything like it, and I don't think I probably will see anything ever like it. Rich, what did you think of it?
I can agree with you that I've never seen anything like it. I have never seen anything like it. I can't say it's a good film in any way at all. It's an experience. And part of the experience is the fact that Glover tours himself with the film, and the film itself is incorporated into a night of...
It's like you're going to a freak show.
Yeah. He'll do weird spoken word before with slides, and he'll do a Q&A afterwards, and knowing he's in the cinema with you, he sits and watches the film with you, and if that wasn't part of the environment and the atmosphere that I watched the film in, I don't know whether I would have even kept watching it. It is totally unpleasant. It bounces between being unpleasant and being tedious. And it's also just incredibly offensive. And I know it's trying to push my taboos. And seeing a man with cerebral palsy have sex and then strangle women in incredibly graphic ways. And then knowing that this was the man that wrote the film. And knowing that he died a month after shooting the film. All this baggage just makes it a truly bizarre experience.
Glover is going on record and saying that it's an autobiographical, psychosexual, fantastical retelling of Stewart's kind of outlook on life and his interaction with women. So, but
just,
it does,
just like my relationship with Mike's girlfriend.
Actually. Oh my God.
And it has a very nasty end, but hopefully that's, you know. So.
Only in the movies.
Del Winnie.
Well, I'll be drinking lots more Del Winnie. So, in summary, it sounds like, in relation to It's Fine, Everything's Fine, that A, you both are going to hell, and I may or may not be, but certainly not for watching this film. And B, you know, I hate to say it, but it's not fine and everything's not fine.
Everything's terrible.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, folks, you might never be able to see this film unless, of course, Mr. Glover comes back to our fair shores. There is a third film, apparently, in the trilogy. The previous film is called What Is It? Which is a whole different kettle of fish, and this is a strange sort of biblical sort of epic. Whereas this is just like something that's like the underbelly of Nick. So it's like a David Lynch film that's been dropped in the sewer. So, you know, look it up. That's my advice. On the batshit crazy barometer, this film, I can't even... It breaks the mercury. It's like the spirit level's gone funky. I can't give you a proper reading on this. It's just...
I can vouch for that. I can't say...
No rating?
I don't know if you'd call it a 1 or a 10 or what. It just... I don't know what it is.
A minus 50 or plus 100.
Out of 10 abused caretakers?
Would that be somewhere in the... It's got to be somewhere in the millions.
Yeah. Wow. It breaks the scale on abusing and strangling caretakers.
So, okay. Yeah. Sounds fairly awful. But thank you so much for joining us, Zach. And we'll see you next episode.
If I can help and let people know.
And time for more Del Winnie.
Oh, that's horrible.
I was walking on the ground, I didn't make a sound, and then I turned around, I saw a clown. Clown. Clowny clown clown. I hate you, clown. Your ugly frown.
Well, that's about it for the very first official episode of the Parallax Podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell that ratty looking bummy guy with the shopping trolley and the cans down the street. Who else should they tell, Rich?
Tell my mom. Tell my mom. She thinks I'm doing nothing with my life.
Well, that's just not true. That's plain untrue.
Yeah, well, tell my mom.
I will. I will write her a letter. What did we talk about, Rich? The Killer Elite and Carnage?
Yeah, and Contagion and The Wonderful Midnight in Paris.
Yes, I hear the salty scent of sarcasm in the voice there. You actually booed my review. It's going to sound quite funny, but I listen back to that, I'm sure.
Like, take it as a compliment. I boo lots of things, and it's a love boo.
A love boo.
A love boo.
And then we... I don't know what to say about that. I love Boo. And then we did not love Boo, It's Fine, Everything's Fine, because the great Zap Heckburn, well, he was amazing. But that sounds like one weird and strange film. I'm not going to see that, I don't think.
I would tell people to keep their eye out for that film, but I think that film's going to be keeping its eye out for you.
Keeping a low profile. It's like the Human Centipede 2 syndrome. Once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Oh, how great was the Human Centipede 2?
Terrible. You think so too. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
We'll
have a full glass of scotch next time.
I know it's gonna be horrible.
And on that note, farewell.